Jede Folge ein neuer Streifzug durch die Faszination Wissenschaft. Das ist Hessen schafft Wissen, der Podcast mit Erik Lorenz.
Jedes Land hat den Vereinten Nationen zufolge ein Recht auf nachhaltige Entwicklung. Zu Zeiten des Klimawandels wird das Verwirklichen dieses Rechts umso dringlicher. Vergrößert es doch das Gefälle zwischen reichen und armen Ländern zusätzlich. Und letztere sind, das ist ja hinlänglich bekannt, seine Hauptleidtragenden. Müssen Entwicklungsländer nun auf Entwicklungschancen verzichten und Industriestaaten auf Konsum- und Wirtschaftswachstum? Welche Rolle spielen Fragen der Moral und Gerechtigkeit im Umgang mit dem Klimawandel? Über Fragen wie diese unterhalte ich mich in dieser Episode von Hessen schafft Wissen mit Daryl Möllendorf. Er ist Professor für internationale politische Theorie und Philosophie an der Goethe-Universität Frankfurt am Main. Seine Schwerpunkte sind politische, Umwelt- und Moralphilosophie. In den letzten Jahren publizierte er vor allem Artikel und Kapitel zu Klimagerechtigkeit, globaler Gerechtigkeit, Hoffnung sowie der Lehre vom gerechten Krieg. Also äußerst zeitgemäße und hochgradig relevante Themen, über die wir gleich sprechen werden, zumindest über einige dieser Themen. Und zwar, und das ist eine Besonderheit dieser Folge, zum allerersten Mal in der Geschichte dieses Podcasts auf Englisch. Auch wenn Professor Möllendorfs Name deutsch klingt, er kommt aus den USA. Und er spricht zwar gutes Deutsch, unterrichtet an der Goethe-Universität aber in Englisch, das zudem ja nun einmal auch weltweit die Sprache der Wissenschaft und an hessischen Hochschulen schon längst Standard in international ausgerichteten Studiengängen ist. Ich wünsche viel Spaß bei unserem Gespräch. Please enjoy. Hi, Professor Dr. Möllendorf. Thank you so much for joining us today. Thanks for making the time.
Oh, thank you very much for the opportunity. I'm delighted to be here.
I'd like to start our conversation with a quote of yours that I found on your page on the Goethe University's website, and it goes as follows. The sort of philosophical research I do is driven by problems in our lives and the world we live in. These matters are more important to me than problems in the literature, unquote. Was that always the case for you, that you found more meaning in real-world issues than in exclusively abstract or theoretical problems that are discussed in literature?
No, I didn't always start out thinking about my professional and scientific work in that way. When I was in graduate school, I actually thought, although I had political commitments and I was a political activist as a graduate student, I thought it best back then, which is a long time ago now, of course, to try to keep those interests separate from my scientific and academic interests and to have a kind of a barrier between the two. I thought it was probably best both for the scientific work and for my activism to do that. But over time, so I wrote a dissertation, for example, on Hegel's philosophy of subjective spirit, which is what we might think of as philosophy of mind nowadays. But over time, that just felt unsustainable to me. And the enthusiasm that I had was much more driven in the direction of the problems of the world. And I realized that I could make a contribution, to addressing those problems. And I could do it in a way that was with integrity, that could still maintain the scientific integrity of my work. Mm-hmm.
You mentioned that pretty early on in your career and in your maybe also political awakening, you also were active as an activist. That's a word that you just used. Would you talk a little bit about that? What was your early activism about?
These were the mid-80s in the United States. And at that time, there were a number of interventions by the United States in Central America, in El Salvador, and there was pressure being put on a regime in Nicaragua. And I was part of a movement called the Anti-Intervention Movement at that time. And then I was quite involved in the student movement against apartheid. There was an effort back then to get educational institutions to divest their portfolios, their investments from South Africa holdings. And that was a major concern of mine.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then your thinking when you started to work as a philosopher, when you wrote your dissertation and so on, you mentioned your thinking changed and evolved in terms of how you can combine maybe your activism and your scientific work and maybe put a little bit of activism into the scientific work without losing integrity or while maintaining integrity. Would you mind talking a little bit about that, how, from your perspective, that is possible? Basically, An activist, in my understanding, usually has a pretty specific point of view that he or she is trying to make, while a scientist normally, I suppose, should be pretty open-minded and really just follow the facts. How can these two things go together, ideally, in your understanding?
The danger, of course, is that you argue for things that you believe in as an activist, and you don't then consider the problems with the arguments that you're presenting, and you don't consider them adequately for political reasons. And that is something that you certainly, if you adopt this approach that I said I came around to, that you have to be on guard against. So it doesn't necessarily make you the best activist in the world, because you can come to the conclusion that the positions that you hold dear are positions that can't be justified scientifically. But on the other hand, to the extent that they can be justified scientifically, you're also doing service to the causes that you hold dear. So the effort is to take seriously the scientific and, in my case, the moral philosophical dimensions of those concerns, and to see whether or not they can be defended, or they can be argued for from a rigorous philosophical perspective.
And when you talk about the causes that are dear to you, what are some of these causes today? What kind of problems are you referring to in that quote that I read? These problems in our lives and the world we live in, quote unquote.
So in the last 20 years or so, my attention has been drawn largely to questions of global inequality and to what's wrong with global inequality, what's wrong with the major differences in life prospects between those of us who are fortunate enough to live in highly industrialized developed countries and people who are living in middle and low income countries. That's, I think, a major injustice in the world today. Mm-hmm. I've also, through that work, slowly developed a greater and greater interest in climate change. And actually, a great deal of my work now, most of my work is directed towards climate change and, broadly speaking, environmental problems that have to do with related issues, the problems of the Anthropocene, one might say. Along the way, I've worked on war. I've worked on the justice of war and talked to consider when, if ever, it's permissible to go to war, but also the morality of leaving wars, of exiting wars, which hadn't really been considered very much. And the war in Afghanistan was something that gave me 20 years to think about, unfortunately, mm-hmm. in that mm-hmm. regard. And all of these are fairly depressing topics in many ways. And so recently, I've also begun to think a lot more about hope and about the justification hope for hope and the kind of thing that hope is.
That is a lot of pretty big topics, topics of the kind that one way or the other are probably relevant to all of us and that we all should think about, and also gives us more than enough material to cover in this conversation, of course. One of the things you mentioned is the general topic of equality and justice, and then also at a later stage of your career, climate change, which is one of your main focus areas today. And based on my preparation for this conversation, my understanding is that in your work, you focus pretty strongly on the correlation between both, or the context, like how does climate change lead or even increases global inequality? And I believe a term that is being used pretty often, especially in your work, is the term climate justice. What does that term generally refer to?
Yes, climate justice can refer to many different things, but there's two or three that are usually prominent. One is the concern about the relationship between climate change and global poverty, and how climate change can make conditions for the poorest people in the world much worse. So this is a question of global justice, essentially, a question of what people in affluent industrialized countries owe to the poor people of the world in relation to climate change. And that can be both with respect to trying to mitigate climate change, why we have reasons on behalf of the poor of the world to take mitigation very seriously. Mitigation here means to try to prevent climate change from becoming even worse than it already is. But it can also be a question about the nature of the mitigation policies themselves. So there is a worry for people who live in countries that are going through processes in which they're trying to ameliorate or eradicate poverty, that the kinds of policies that might mitigate climate change are also policies that could make development prospects worse. And that would happen if those policies increase the cost of energy. So we often talk about one of the ways to mitigate climate change is via putting a price on CO2 emissions. But of course, putting a price on CO2 emissions, as we know, increases the cost of the use of energy. And for countries that are going through a developmental process in which they're trying to eradicate poverty, increasing the cost of energy can be very detrimental to that project. So I think one of the major questions of climate justice is a question of how we can achieve climate change mitigation on the one hand, and continue to support countries that are trying to eradicate poverty on the other hand. So that's a central question of climate justice. But other questions are questions about our duties to future generations. So most of the effects of climate change are effects that will be felt in the distant future. They'll be felt by young people in this generation, but by their children and by their grandchildren and by their grandchildren's children and so on. These effects extend quite far into the future. And so that puts pressure on our conceptual abilities to think about what we owe other people when those people aren't yet born, but will exist far into the future. And then there's a question of what's sometimes referred to as the just transition. So within industrialized countries, dealing with climate change means shutting down the fossil fuel industry. And of course, many people's lives and livelihoods are attached to that industry. And there's questions of how to affect a transition like that in a way that's just and in a way that allows for prospects for people who are involved in those communities or involved in those industries.
That shows that it is quite a complex and multifaceted term, climate justice, right? So let me try to sum it up just to make sure I got it all. So it's basically about inequality of different dimensions, right? It's about inequality or quality, ideally. I mean, it's a scale and we strive, of course, towards quality. But in fact, there's a lot of inequality in existence between, I would say, the rich and the poor nations, generally speaking, the global north and the south probably, but also between generations, that's what you mentioned. And both is true in terms of the direct consequences of climate change and how to deal with that, but also in terms of the ability to mitigate climate change as well and to try to participate in this global effort to stop, or at least to be realistic, slow down climate change, which is, of course, also another dimension of inequality because poorer nations will struggle more to do that.
Yeah, that's correct. And then the question of just transitions is a question of what we owe to people and communities in industrialized countries who are involved in the extraction and the refinement and the processing of fossil fuels.
And this owing to these people, this phrase also already hints that it is actually also quite a moral question, or it is a question of morals very much, right?
Right.
It's not only a question of economic or environmental necessity that we're discussing, but it's a question of moral and how we think about that as well.
Yeah, that suggested it's a question of justice. So it's a dimension of climate justice.
Yeah. Well, this is such a complex topic that very obviously touches upon all kinds of scientific field like politics, technology and innovation, geostrategic interests, and so on. How can we even start to think about these issues in terms of justice and morals? Like, how, I know it's a very big question, but I don't know if there are specific methodologies or ways how you can explain how you approach these complex topics in your work.
So I think I'm a philosopher by training, yes. Although my primary professorship now is in political science. I also have a secondary appointment in philosophy at Goethe University, Frankfurt. Mm-hmm. And I think for philosophers who are thinking about these issues, who who want to maintain a degree of realism. And by that, I mean they want to maintain a degree of connection to real life events, and they want what they have to say to be something that's relevant to policymakers and activists and citizens. It's important to not just approach this problem as if they're thinking about it. They're the first person to have ever thought about it, right? That they're thinking about it entirely fresh, that this is an entirely new problem that that has never been on the minds of people. Because, of course, it has been on the minds of people, and it's been on the minds of people for several decades now. And in particular, the countries of the world under the auspices of the United Nations Convention on Climate Change came together in the early 1990s and formed a framework convention on climate change. And this is a legal
document. It's called the United Nations Framework on Climate Change, right?
Yeah, the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, that's right. And it's a legal document, but it contains a number of important norms. The norms are attempts to guide policy, to guide and to restrict and to constrain policy. And one of the important norms in that document is what's stated as the right to promote sustainable development. And I think we can get a handle on thinking about what is permissible and with respect to climate change policy, in part by taking that idea very seriously, that there is a right to promote sustainable development. So part of what I've been trying to do is to think about what the moral justification of such a right would be. So even if people hadn't necessarily codified it in a legal document, would there be a justification for it? Although I think the fact that people have codified it into a legal document is very, very important. But what are the justifications for such a right? And what does the right really mean? What does it entail? So this is a way of thinking about the problem of climate change as a philosopher in a way that speaks directly to concerns that people have, that people are already in their debates referring to, and that countries are orienting their action and debates around.
And some of that thought process and some of these analyses, I believe you have put them in a book that has been published in 2014, one of the books you've written so far. It's called The Moral Challenge of Dangerous Climate Change. What were some of the main thoughts and observations you presented in that book?
Yeah, that's right. That's exactly right. And so in that book, a great deal of that book is devoted to this idea that we've just been talking about, about the importance of the right to promote sustainable development and how it constrains climate change policy, how it requires climate change policy to be sensitive to the needs of low and medium income countries that have problems of poverty and are seeking to simultaneously and or deal with that problem of poverty as well as negotiate with richer nations for a climate change agreement. So that's really central to the efforts of that book. But I also in the book talk about some concerns that have arisen in climate change economics that are essentially philosophical questions. So these are questions about the extent to which we should invest in climate infrastructure or mitigation infrastructure on behalf of future generations, knowing that the sort of time horizon that we're talking about when we think about future generations is in principle infinite. We don't know when humanity might end. And once we begin to think about things this way, it looks like we're looking at benefits that stretch out over an infinite time horizon. And sometimes economists, when they think about that, become concerned that the benefits to future generations would just swamp the costs that to present generations. And so they engage in what's called discounting the well-being of future generations. And that seems morally suspect. So I talk a bit about that in the book and about the problems associated with that. And then I think also you can't really talk about these issues adequately, talk about them thoroughly without thinking about the value of the natural world and the value of biodiversity in particular. And so that's something it's not so much concerned about questions of poverty, but it's certainly a dimension of the climate change poverty, of the climate change problem that is very, very important, I think, to most people. And so I try to make sense in the book also of the value of biodiversity. So there's lots of aspects, lots of things that are taken up in the book.
And I'd definitely like to try to get into some of these aspects, at least in our conversation in a bit. But first, let me ask you, okay, you published that in 2014, and you, of course, followed these issues and worked on them even longer. And of course, we know that since 2014, quite a bit has changed. Since then, we had the Paris Climate Agreement, but also so far, worldwide CO2 emissions keep rising. So there is a kind of effort and an increased political awareness and a public awareness, but also many people feel change is happening by far too slowly. And you have already mentioned earlier on that in recent years, you have started to deal more with the topic of hope and the philosophy of hope, that being one of your new focus fields in your research. Would you tell us a little bit about that? Like, what kind of research on hope have you done, and then how far does that inform your work and your thoughts on climate justice today?
Yeah, so I actually first started thinking about hope quite a while ago. I think I published my first paper on hope back in 2009. And that stemmed from an experience that I had of living in South Africa. I was a professor in Johannesburg at the University of the Witwatersrand for 6.5 years. And this was in the late 90s and the early 2000s, in which the country was going through this deeply important and profound democratic transition. And one of the things that puzzled me about that was that there were so many white South Africans at the time who didn't seem to be hopeful enough about the future of the country, whereas most Black South Africans were hopeful. And that made me want to think carefully about hope as a political value. And so I wrote a paper back in the early 2000s about hope as a political value. And ever since then, hope has been something that has been of interest to me, but it's something that I hadn't really had a lot of time to devote much scientific effort to. Recently, things changed, and I felt the need to talk and to think more about hope. And the things that changed were twofold. They were personal and they were political. The personal is that I was quite sick for a period, the end of 2016 and 2017. I had a life-threatening illness, and I had a stem cell transplant here in Frankfurt, and that was a period in which, for me, hope took on particular importance, and I thought about it very personally. But also shortly after that, I began to realize, once I had survived, that I wanted to devote myself again to my scientific work, and that the circumstances of climate change were even more dire than they had been when I published the book in 2014. And hope seemed particularly important as a source of motivation for dealing with the climate problem. And then in 2018, 2019, this student movement just erupted onto the scene because of the courageous efforts, not only of one young Swedish girl, but of many other young students. And that seemed to me to be a very positive sign, and a sign that that gave some of us who had been working on this issue for a long time a certain sense of hope that maybe now there would be the kind of movement that seemed to be necessary to push leaders in a direction to deal with the problems of climate change. So I began once again to think scientifically about hope, to think both about its role in the politics of climate change, and also about when hope seems to be justified and when it's not justified, when it's just wishful thinking.
And I think that's such an interesting discussion, because I also talked about that for another show I'm doing with Dr. Jane Goodall at once, the famous activist who of course also talks about hope very often. It's part of most of her book titles and movies and so on. And in my perception, if you don't really think about it that much, at first glance, hope does sound a little bit like wishy-washy and wishful thinking. Basically, hope is what you try to have once the actual reason for expecting a positive outcome becomes smaller and smaller. Basically, you're sitting in a plane and it's going down and the pilot is giving you the information, I think we might not survive. And then what is left for you? Hope, basically, some abstract sense of maybe somehow it will work out anyway. But what you're telling me, what Jane Goodall is saying, and also I think many other people, is that hope is actually something very real that can have very real and powerful and tangible real-world impacts, right?
Yeah, no, that's right. And that reasonable hope is based upon things that are going on in the world. So I use the term in a book that will be published next year in 2022 called Mobilizing Hope. Yes. I use the term hope maker for things that are going on in the world, for arguments that we can draw from the sciences, from theories that we have about how climate change might be brought about. Any kind of evidence or argument that would give us reason to think that the outcome was possible is what I call a hope maker. And the thought is that hope can't be entirely devoid of this kind of evidence or these kinds of reasons or arguments. If it is, then it is just wishful thinking. But a very important hope maker, I think, in the case of climate change is the activism of young people, that this is something that has given us reason to think that there's potential to change the politics of climate change, that given us reasons to think that political leaders will be put under a certain kind of pressure to deal with the problem that they hadn't really been adequately put under prior to this. So hope makers can include this kind, these efforts at mobilization, and it can be in that regard also contagious when we see people. There's a kind of contagion aspect that can be fostered by those sorts of politics. So the hope that some people have to take the streets can be hope that others will have to join them to take to the streets, and so on.
You mentioned your upcoming book, Mobilizing Hope. You kindly provided me with a digital copy prior to this conversation. And I hope I'm not giving away too much by mentioning that you quote Martin Luther King Jr. in the preface, and you quote him with these words: "Today's despair is a poor chisel to carve out tomorrow's justice." So it's basically exactly what we're discussing right now, a pretty powerful piece of motivation to show and to indicate that despair is not helpful to create a healthy and just future. We need hope to move forward. That's basically the point that he's making there as well. And now that we've basically established the value in hope and have been talking about that, how can we mobilize hope? That's your book title, right? And I know you wrote a whole book about it, but if hope is that powerful and important, and if, as we can see, I mentioned it in passing, change currently is happening pretty slowly compared to what would need to happen, how can we mobilize hope in terms of climate change and climate justice?
Well, we can begin by educating ourselves, by understanding the nature of the problem, and by understanding the possible solutions to the problem. But then, of course, it's not just an individual matter. We need to talk to others about the problem. We need to encourage others to think seriously about the problem. And then we need to encourage people to act. And people often ask, well, what can I do? And of course, there's a range of things that people can do. Of course, they can change the way that they consume, whether it be cutting down the amount of meat in their diet, or whether it be driving less, or any of these sorts of things. But I think that there are forms of political action that are especially important. And this isn't limited to just voting for parties who seem to be making the right kinds of promises. But also it means being willing to demonstrate on behalf of climate change, being willing to not necessarily being a political organizer, that may be only for a few, but being willing to engage in events that others organize, being willing to show support for these events, I think is very important.
And if we talk about the political dimension that you mentioned, and also the dimension of, like, on a society level, I'm just drawing up here an interview that you have given a while ago to the university newspaper of the Goethe University. And in there, you mention two overall kinds of hope that also remain on a different level from what we discussed right now. I'm just trying to spontaneously translate it. Of course, the interview is in German. The first dimension of hope you mentioned there is the hope for more moral thinking and acting as a specifically human ability. So basically the hope that people in highly developed countries could start more and more to perceive it as their duty and as a question of justice to support, for example, people in developing nations. But you also point out that so far this first dimension of hope you mentioned there has not really worked out.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say that it hasn't worked out entirely. That might be putting it too strongly, but certainly it hasn't proven yet to be the dominant source of motivation when it comes to climate change, international climate change policies. But the idea, it's not an idea that's unique to me or that's something that I developed on my own, but the 20th century American political philosopher John Rawls at one point said something to the effect that if human beings are simply driven by narrow self-interest, if that's the only source of motivation that people have, then all of our efforts to try to create a better world and to try to create more just societies are probably for naught. We can't rely just on ingenious institutions that will channel self-interest in the right sort of way, such that, with the right kind of social engineering, just institutions will develop. It has to be, if there's any hope for justice in the world, it has to be that people aren't just bound to their own interests, but they're motivated by a sense of duty to others and a sense of justice to others. And I think that that's right. And I think unless there's reason to believe that people are motivated by more than self-interest, there really is very little hope. And I think that there is reason to believe that. I think we see lots of evidence of that. And part of what we need to do is to get people, in the words of Abraham Lincoln, to act on the better angels of their soul, right? And that's not something that we can rely on exclusively, of course, as well. I mean, part of the ingenuity of just social institutions is that they try to, as much as possible, try to align self-interest with interest in justice. But we have to be able to hope that when difficult questions in which people are placed under to act on their own interests or to act on interests of justice, that people will reliably or often enough choose justice over their self-interest. This is why many people don't cheat on their taxes, even when they doubt that they would get caught by cheating on their if they were to cheat on their taxes, because they have a sense that it's their duty to pay their taxes. And I think that's what just institutions require, and that's what a solution to climate change ultimately will require. It will require people taking seriously the idea that they have duties to the poor of the world, not to let the part of the planet that they live in be utterly destroyed by climate change.
Yes, I absolutely agree. But I also have to ask, because you said ultimately this is what hopefully will happen and needs to happen. But of course, also we are very aware of the fact that we don't have that much time left anymore for this ultimate hope to materialize. It would need to happen pretty quickly. Do you feel that the change that we are seeing in public awareness and policymaking and so on is even close to happening fast enough?
I don't think it's happening fast
enough to be able to rely on that dimension.
Yeah, I don't think it's happening fast enough yet, and I don't think the kinds of ambitions that have been expressed are international climate change negotiations are sufficient either. So what I want to say is that there's a difference between believing that an outcome is likely to come about, which is characterized, I think, by a sense of optimism about the likelihood of the outcome coming about and the events coming to pass. There's a difference between that on the one hand and hoping that the outcome or the events will come about. And the latter, that is hoping that the events will come about, is something that we might have even with less evidence than we'd have if we were optimistic about it. We can hope for something to occur even when we don't think it's likely, just so long as we think it's still sufficiently possible that our efforts might make a difference and the efforts of others might make a difference. Even if the odds are long, they're not impossible. And I think that's really where hope becomes most important. And that's why hope is more important than, say, optimism. Hope is something that is especially important in darker times. And as long as there's a light of possibility, then hope is especially important.
So basically, it can give us a kind of North Star that we at least can work towards, so that we have an aspirational direction for our efforts, even if we should fall short in actually reaching the precise North Star. It hopefully enabled and empowered us to move closer into that direction.
Right. Yeah, that's good. Yeah.
But you also mentioned beyond this kind of hope for an increased moral thinking and acting as a specifically human ability, you also mentioned that in terms of just institutions and so on, ideally they also are able to, as much as possible, align our inherent self-interest with sustainable and just developments, right? So basically, another hope would be, maybe it sounds a little bit more cynical, but I'm sure it also plays an important role, the hope that we can align our sense, maybe a healthy sense, a smart sense for self-interest, with objectives that support our efforts in fighting climate change or slowing it down.
Yeah, no, that's right. And so here, I draw on my own personal experience. When I was a patient in the German hospital system, that I had just wonderful care from the doctors and nurses in the hospital system at the Uniklinik here in Frankfurt. And of course, these are people who, you know, they're concerned about their paycheck. They're concerned about having their vacations. They're concerned about, there being fair working conditions for them. And so they have all of the concerns that we might think of as associated with self-interest, but they're also doing a job that is immensely important from the perspective of social justice. They're providing good health care that's available for every person living in Germany. And part of the genius of the arrangement of the healthcare system is that it's able to align the self-interests of these people operating in the system with this broader goal of social justice for decent healthcare for everybody living in Germany, regardless of their income. And of course, these people, again, they're not just driven by self-interest, right? They conscientiously do their job, and they often do their job above and beyond what they're expected to do. So it's not as if the whole thing just runs on self-interest. There's a sense of duty there too. And there's a sense on the part of German voters who vote to maintain this system and to have a portion of their paychecks go to the support of the system. There's a sense of justice and solidarity involved in the maintenance of the system. And I think that there's a certain ingenuity there, a certain genius there to just social institutions that they're able to do this. And what we would hope to be able to do is to be able to extend institution building like that has been accomplished in some of the countries of Western Europe, that we can to some extent extend that kind of institution building to the international framework and to provide just institutions of energy consumption and to foster the energy transition that will be necessary to mitigate climate change, to get the climate emergency under control. Yeah.
And a self-interest dimension in there would probably be something like the understanding that if we don't do that, and if we don't support, for example, developing nations with their energy transformation, that there will be no wall high enough or no ocean big enough, I think that's approximately how you put it in one interview, to prevent these challenges in developing nations from beating us and from coming to our borders. So basically, one way or the other, we have to deal with these challenges. So it is in our self-interest to make sure these countries also do as well as possible.
Yeah, no, that's right, of course, as well. And there's also a consideration of solidarity here, too, that that what's in the interests of people in the developing world is also in our interests, both for the reasons you just mentioned, but also because we know that, just for example, agriculture is a sort of integrated global system. And when there's a massive crop failure in one part of the country, one part of the world, this can have ripple effects across the world and create hunger thousands of kilometers away from where it occurred. And so given the way the global economy is now integrated, it's very hard to be isolated from the effects that happen in another part of the world.
But despite this understanding, of course, there are many challenges relating to making the first step and acting. And one of the challenges is the problem of collective acting, I think it's called. What does that phrase refer to?
Yeah, so collective action problems come in many different forms, but a sort of classic version of the problem is when there's something that's in the interests of several different actors to see happen, but when none of the actors taken individually has sufficient reason to pursue the kind of action that would produce the outcome. And this is sometimes referred to as a sort of a collective version of something called the prisoner's dilemma problem, or sometimes it takes the form of what's called a tragedy of commons. And there's a way of looking at climate change mitigation as being an instance of this kind of problem. And the way of looking at it is that it looks as if every country, some more than others, of course, but every country would benefit from climate change mitigation, keeping global warming within 1.5 degrees or not much beyond 1.5 degrees is something that would be a global public benefit for everybody. But in international relations climate of suspicion, where countries mistrust one another, no country sees it as being in its interest to move first, because if it moves first and others don't move, then it may suffer as a result, whether economically or in some other way. And if a sufficient number of other countries move without it moving, then it can enjoy the benefits of everybody else having moved. So one classic way of looking at the problem of climate change mitigation is along those lines. I will say, I think that way of looking at the problem is to some extent, it's not entirely outmoded, but to some extent it's outmoded because of the revolution in energy generation technology. Now it's the case that in many markets around the world, renewable energy is actually cheaper than fossil fuels. And to the extent that that's the case, countries might actually see it in their interest. China, I think, is an example of this to some extent. Countries can see it in their interest of developing robust systems of renewable energy. Mm-hmm. And indeed even gaining from doing that by exporting that technology and making money to other countries. So as renewable energy becomes cost competitive with fossil fuels, that particular problem, I think, becomes less severe. And that's, again, a hopeful sign. That's a different kind of hope maker, right? That's a hope maker that doesn't have to do with the courage of the young people taking to the streets, but to developments, to some extent, the result of conscious public policy, but developments in the energy market that are moving in the right direction.
Yeah, and that is really nice to see, because I'm sure, like, I don't know, when it was in the 90s at some point, there was exactly that situation, that it was a pretty big investment and a certain kind of risk to, I don't know, get into solar power. And now that we are quite a few years later, basically everybody who can is trying to push these technologies as fast as possible, China being one of these nations who is pretty active in that regard, because it is not a risk as much anymore, but a clear competitive advantage if you are doing well.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
There are, of course, different strategies for dealing with climate change on a pretty general level. There's like something like protecting the environment, protecting the climate, and ideally preventing it from changing. And of course, there's also strategies that focus on adapting to climate change, for example, by building dams. How do you as a, of course, I think we all have a sense which of these options, unfortunately, by now is more realistic, but how do you as a philosopher think about such strategies and as they relate to the questions of justice and equality?
So the planet has already warmed over 1 degree centigrade. And we've been witnessing the effects of that this past year, in particular with the flooding in Germany, the flooding in China, the fires in Siberia and in California. And now we have this massive hunger in Madagascar, in which people are literally dying because of a lack of food. All of these can be chalked up to, if not directly to the to the heating that's in the system already, then what we can say with greater certainty is that these are the kinds of events that will be much more likely to happen now that the climate is warming. And of course, that's the important thing when it comes to planning. It's not a question of whether we can say with some kind of super certainty that any of these events have been caused by climate change, but that in the future, as we try to plan for a warmer world, that these are the kind of events that we have to plan for. And that means that we have to adapt to the changes that are in the system. If we hope to limit warming by means of mitigation to 1.5 degrees, we're going to see more of these kinds of events than exists now with a warming of 1 or 1.1 degrees. So adaptation has to be part of any response to climate change, just as obviously mitigation is important, so is adaptation. And adaptation raises many of the same moral problems that that mitigation does, but there's something that I think can be a bit more tricky about adaptation policy, which is, while it's obvious to countries that each country has to work and to do something to mitigate climate change, and that you don't ever achieve net zero global emissions unless every country actually itself also achieves net zero emissions, it's not immediately obvious to a country that the adaptation concerns of some other country somewhere else in the world are or should be its own adaptation concerns. Many countries might be led to the false belief that they can adapt on their own to climate change and not worry about the adaptation successes of other countries. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a false belief for the reasons that you and I were discussing just a few moments ago, the fact that we live in this interconnected world, the worry that climate disasters in other countries will produce ripple effects that will spread around the world suggests that it's that adaptation, also like mitigation, is something that should be a common concern of every country in the world.
So there is this kind of danger of adaptation strategies having a more desolidarizing effect than bringing us together.
Yeah, I mean, it just occurs to me to use this word, but you might think of the danger as being adaptation nationalism, right? And that comes that comes in the context of our recent experience with COVID vaccination, in which the problem has been up to this point the problem of vaccine nationalism, that there's been insufficient cooperation amongst countries of the world to make sure that the vaccine is distributed in a just way. And due to that lack of attention, we have variants, for example, that develop in India, the Delta variant, that now are a problem for the rest of the world. And there is, I think, a similar danger of adaptation nationalism.
That's a very good example, because, of course, with regard to adaptation, different countries with different status of development will have different means to adapt, right? Not every country in the world will have the means, I don't know what it takes, to build massive dams or to take other kinds of measures. So this kind of adaptation nationalism is not only ineffective on a global scale, but also potentially, or maybe even probably, highly unjust or unjust.
Yeah, amongst the countries that are most affected by climate change, according to scientific projections, the vast majority of these are also the countries that are least able to adapt on their own due to lack of resources, lack of financial resources and other resources.
Yeah, that's a very important point. They are most strongly affected. They have the smallest ability to meet these challenges, and very often they also contributed to the problems in the first place.
To the problem, of course, yeah.
In the least manner, yeah.
And sadly, the score with respect to international COVID vaccine policy suggests we still have a long ways to go to overcoming the sense of nationalism in response to these kinds of emergencies, these kinds of interconnected global problems that quickly become emergencies.
I'd have a series of, four or five questions, a little bit more specific. Let's just go through them, but don't feel like you have to respond in just one or two sentences. First question would be, do we in our industrial nations need to limit or forgo our consumption and economic growth? That's, I think, one of the main questions that is being raised and that people worry about if that is the case, and if so, what does it mean?
Yeah, this is a question that I think has arisen especially amongst some climate change activists who have looked at the wasteful consumption that exists in much of the advanced developed countries, countries where the richest people in the world live, and they rightly noted that the way in which we produce and consume now produces greenhouse gases. And the thought is then that if we want to do something about the production of greenhouse gases, then we need to, one of the ways of doing something about the production of greenhouse gases and other environmental problems is simply to produce and to consume less. I think that there's reasons to think that this is not the right response. It's not the right response, in part because it's just an inadequate response. We've seen, just in the course of recent history, we've seen two major downturns in the global economy, the Great Recession of 2008-2009, and then the downturn now as a result of the COVID pandemic. And in both cases, these are major downturns in which the economies of the world has fallen more than it had fallen at any time since the Great Recession. And although there has been a corresponding decline in emissions, it's been quite slight and overall not adequate. And in fact, last year, emissions continued to grow despite the economic, the relative economic downturn. So as
last year, you mean 21, right?
Yeah, sorry. As a response to the problem of climate change, it doesn't seem to be getting at the doesn't seem to be providing a solution that would be realistic unless we were to shut down the entire global economy. I mean, that would certainly be a way to stop emissions, but it wouldn't be a morally justified way because it would create havoc around the world, and in particular, it would hurt the developing countries of the world most. I think what it indicates is that the way to address the problem is to break the link between the production of CO2 emissions and economic activity. If we want to have an adequate solution to the problem, we're going to have to figure out ways to produce and to consume that don't produce CO2 emissions. And this is the mitigation project, right? This is the project of transitioning to a green economy, to a net zero carbon economy. And to the extent that we are able to do that, then we're also able to allow an increase in consumption, and in particular, an increase in energy generation in the developing world, which is what's absolutely needed in order to deal with the problem of global poverty. So if we're going to deal adequately with that problem, if the countries that are suffering most with poverty within their borders are going to deal with that problem, they're going to have to massively increase their consumption of energy. And the only way that that can be done is by transitioning to a fossil fuel-free economy, a zero-carbon economy. If that can be accomplished, then the question of growth and consumption makes no difference, at least from the perspective of climate change. There may be other
environmental pressures that are caused by growth and consumption. But as soon as the economy is decoupled from CO2 emissions, and that's just not any longer, growth is not any longer an issue.
Part of what you just said directly leads to my second question in that segment. It's pretty strongly related to the first question. First question being if we in our industrial nations need to limit our growth. Second question would be, do developing countries need to give up some of their development potentials for the sake of protecting our climate?
Yeah, again, I mean, you're right that it's just another side of the same question. So,
yes.
If it's the case that we can achieve this net zero carbon global economy, then the answer to that is no. That the projects of economic growth and poverty eradication in those countries can proceed at full speed by means of renewable energy. If it turns out that we, for one reason or another, are not moving fast enough with the development of or the achievement of the net zero carbon goals, then the world is going to have some difficult trade-offs to make, either to allow more climate change to exist, which is going to cause problems in the future, or to attempt to curb the emissions in the highly developed countries. And I think politically doing the latter is going to be very hard to do. It's going to be very hard to convince developing countries that they should have to sacrifice, that poverty should have to continue in these countries so that the lifestyles of the highly developed countries can, so that people living in the highly developed countries can continue to enjoy the lifestyles that they have. So I don't see that as I don't think it's morally acceptable. I think it's politically unrealistic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Third of these more specific and maybe slightly uncomfortable questions. Can we still fly around the world for travel or for meeting family members with a good conscience?
Well, I mean, if 20 years from now, jet fuels are still carbon-based fuels, the answer will have to be no. It's clear that we have to do something in the next 20 to 30 years. We want to achieve net zero global emissions by the middle of this century. Whether or not we can continue to fly around after the next 20 or 30 years is going to depend upon the developments in technologies. There are some hopeful signs here as well that there are forms of biofuels that are being developed that are usable in jet engines. There's some possibilities for smaller aircraft to be electrified. And there's been some developments or some research done into using hydrogen. So I think the future is uncertain with respect to that. But what we would hope is that our policies are public policies in countries where there's a lot of innovation going on, technological innovation going on, that public policy can encourage the innovations that are needed to ensure that we can continue to have the kind of benefits of a globalized economy that we would all like to enjoy. Right now, should we be flying around in jet aircraft around the world? I think that we should be taking efforts to the extent that we can to limit our flights, just as there are things that we can do in our personal lives to limit our consumption of meat and to drive less. But I don't think any of these are as crucial as the policy changes that we need to see to produce global mass changes in overall national and global policy.
Policy changes and, based on what you just said in all three of these questions, innovation that we are urgently waiting for.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's going to be very important that we foster innovation. And there are just some areas in which innovation still needs to be promoted. We need better batteries, for example. We've just talked about certain kinds of fuel that will become important. And part of the response to climate change is going to have to be removing CO2 from the atmosphere. We we see already with the amount of CO2 that we have in the atmosphere, drastic changes that are occurring, and storms and flooding and droughts and hunger. Mm-hmm. And if the planet warms another 0.4 degrees, if we even manage to keep the warming to 1.5 degrees, there are going to be serious changes and serious negative changes that are going to impact the well-being of people. And the strategy is what's called a net zero carbon economy. And the net in net zero means that some amount of carbon will be taken out of the atmosphere. And that's going to require a technological change. It's going to require technological developments. Fortunately, some of this technology is now being developed and it's online, but it's not up to scale. And that's going to be a necessary part of the picture. It's not as if this is a technological fix by any means. We have to change our politics, and we have to change the way we produce and consume. But part of it will also involve changes in technology. That's just going to be absolutely necessary.
Yeah, and that's totally understandable, but also, of course, a little bit frustrating, isn't it? Because many of these technological innovations that we need are just in the beginnings of being really developed, are getting ready for the mass market. But the change that we are talking about is already happening right now. Yeah. And also your point with regard to my first question, basically decoupling or destroying the link between growth or economic activity and CO2 emissions also seems like a pretty far way to go from today's point.
Yeah, no, that's right. I mean, the whole thing is worrying. And if it weren't worrying, yeah, there would be no need for hope, right? It's worrying that our political leaders are going to move fast enough. Worrying that they seem to be way too influenced by special interests, in particular the interests of the fossil fuel industry that seem to dominate too much in the politics of too many countries. As a result of that, legislators and policymakers are not responding as they ought to respond to the problem. It's worrying about whether or not we'll be able to neutralize the power of the fossil fuel industry by mass movements in the street. It's worrying that whether or not we'll be able to develop technology as quickly as we can. All of this provides plenty of reasons to stay awake at night and not sleep well. One of the ways to deal with that problem is, I think, to engage in the kinds of activities of the production of hope that I've referred to.
That's almost a very good statement for a conclusion of our conversation. But if you don't mind, I would have two or three more questions if you still have the time.
Sure.
What about the topic of population growth? And how far do we need to address that as a factor for climate change and its mitigation?
So there are two drivers to the climate change problem. I mean, one of the drivers is is our reliance on CO2, or on fossil fuels that produce CO2 to live the kind of lifestyles that we live. And the other is the scale at which this is happening, and that's a function of population. So as with the problem of degrowth, one might say that in the abstract, one of the ways to handle this problem would be either to stabilize population growth or actually to reduce global population. And my response is essentially the same as my response to the problem or the solution of degrowth, which is that if we can achieve a decoupling of fossil fuels from or of economic growth from the use of fossil fuels, then the question of population for the question of climate change, there might be other things we need to worry about with respect to environmental impact. But for the question of climate change, population will not be any longer a problem, because every person that lives in the world, even if there's more of them that live now, as predictably there will be, they won't be emitting CO2 any longer if we achieve a decoupling of CO2 emissions from economic activity. So that has to be our main focus, I think. Moreover, the problem of population growth is a problem that can only really be addressed on a time frame that's that's too long from the perspective of climate change. We have 20 to 30 years to achieve a net zero global economy, and we're not going to make major differences in population growth in 20 or 30 years. And indeed, we actually know how countries stop growing when it comes to population. They stop growing once they receive, once they achieve a level of human development, which makes it no longer attractive to have as many kids from an economic standpoint. And achieving that level of human development requires, again, it requires energy growth within countries so that people can, they can go to schools that have electricity, they can work in factories, have well-paying jobs that are powered by energy, that they can go to hospitals where there's adequate electricity. All of that requires an increase in energy consumption, and it will have to be done by consuming energy that is decoupled from fossil fuels. That's energy that's been produced by means of renewable energy.
I think that's also a very important point that you just made, that basically the challenges that we're facing, and maybe it's kind of obvious, but still I would like to highlight it, the challenges we're facing in the more developed and less developed countries in the world are pretty different, right? In the more developed nations, it's more about, to a certain degree, consumption and how we understand consumption, change our behavior and delinking it from CO2 emissions. And one of the main challenges in the developing nations is to support a sustainable and effective growth, because by these countries achieving a certain economic status and a certain status in terms of wealth and living conditions, that will also support them in almost automatically improving sustainability quota, more or less.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. I mean, the recent history of China is really important in this regard, and it's not talked about nearly as much as it should be. But the end of the 20th century and the beginning of the 21st century, China witnessed a development that's just unprecedented in human history. Hundreds of millions of people were as a result of Chinese policy, pulled out of poverty. So an amazing amelioration of poverty in China as a result of their policies. And it occurred simultaneously with and because of a massive increase in the consumption of energy. Now, unfortunately, the increase in consumption of energy that occurred in that particular case was as a result of fossil fuels. And we now have China as the major emitter of fossil fuels in the world. But the revolution that occurred in China, the way in which Chinese policy was able to pull people out of poverty, and the requirement of energy consumption that went along with that, is something that will have to be witnessed in many other countries around the world. Although they're countries with smaller economies than China in most cases, except in the case of India, it suggests to us that in the face of one major challenge, that is dealing with the problem of climate change and mitigating climate change adequately, we also have another major problem, which is to allow countries to dramatically increase their energy consumption in order to deal with the problem of poverty within their borders. And The only way that both of these two things can be adequately dealt with simultaneously is by achieving a net zero global carbon economy.
Yeah, that is bringing it full circle. Which subjects and classes do you teach at the Goethe University? In which areas can listeners, if they are still thinking about what to study, where would they have the chance to actually have you as a professor?
So I teach in the Institute for Politikwissenschaft and also the Institute for Philosophie. Yeah. And my courses are on political theory and political philosophy. And I teach a range of courses, from courses about climate change and justice to political theory and the Anthropocene. I teach a course on the political theory of Martin Luther King Jr., on John Rawls's theory of justice. Right now, I'm teaching three courses. One is a colloquium on political theory that I teach with my colleague, Rainer Forst. And I'm teaching a seminar on the political theory of hope. and then an introductory Vorlesung on political theory, which sort of goes through some of the important theorists in the history of political philosophy with a particular eye towards contemporary debates.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, sounds interesting. I have already studied, otherwise it would be definitely an option. It was a fascinating conversation. So far, we have one very last segment, I promise you, to go. It will only take very few minutes. It's our lightning round in the end, which would basically mean that I give you the beginning of a sentence and you have the pleasure of finishing it. If you need more than one sentence, that's also fine. Don't worry about that too much. The first one would be this one. My answer to the question if we can really achieve a global climate turnaround is?
I hope so.
My main reason for hope is?
The recent events of students, young people who've taken to the streets, who've courageously taken to the streets and who are inspiring the rest of us to get our acts together and to support the cause of climate change.
Professional success to me means to?
Means being happy with the job that I'm doing and with the workplace that I'm working in. That supports me.
What does it take for you to be happy about that?
I have to have a sense that I am connecting with students, that they care about what I have to say, and that what I have to say is important to the world around me.
An advice that I often give to my students is
to be patient about their career prospects, to be patient about where success might lie, to be imaginative with respect to the possibilities that are out there for them, and to, when something looks like a good opportunity, to take it.
If I were to receive funding for 1 or 2 years with the absolute freedom to work on anything, whatever I found exciting or important, I would?
I'd work on a project that I'm developing right now called Hope for Human Prospects in the Anthropocene.
Wow, so you're basically living your professional dream already.
More or less. Yeah, I'm very fortunate to be here at Goethe University.
That is great. Well, I congratulate you for being able to say that, and I thank you so much for the time that you have given us today. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. It's been a real pleasure to talk to you, and thank you for the really intelligent and challenging questions.
That's very nice of you to say. Thanks. Have a good day. Bye-bye.
You too. Bye-bye.
Hessen schafft Wissen, der Podcast.